8. Reza Shah and the Pahlavi Order, 1925-1941. By the fall of 1925, all that was needed to remove the Qajars and establish the new Pahlavi dynasty seemed to be in place. Ahmad Shah had long been in voluntary exile, with no serious intentions to return. His brother and regent, Muhammad Hassan Mirza, was isolated in Golestan Palace, and the Qajar loyalists were intimidated and silenced, or else had been co-opted, as were the leading Shi'i mujtahids of the time, together with their associates and cohorts. Even Mudarris was enticed to collaborate. The tribal rebellions had been largely quashed, and the most defiant khans exiled or destroyed. The rest walked the line prescribed by the state, at least for the time being. Content with the semblance of order made possible under Pahlavi, the public was willing to endure army officers' abuses of power. Quelling the political opposition by the boisterous police force also was condoned. The public was no longer willing to come out to the streets, except to see the victory arches erected to honour Reza Khan's campaigns. The last pro-Qajar call to demonstration in October 1925 was answered by a heavy show of force, machine guns, and counter-demonstrations in favour of Reza Pahlavi. Women protested on both sides, and a few pro-Pahlavi women demonstrators dared to appear without veiling their faces, condemning the reactionary mullahs and the rotten aristocrats as obstacles to Iran's road to progress. Pillars of the Pahlavi Throne. On October 31, 1925, with an overwhelming majority, and without any substantive debate, the Fifth Majlis passed a bill that abolished the Qajar dynasty and appointed Reza Khan as His Royal Excellency in charge of the provisional government. Abolishing the Qajar dynasty was a clear overture to Reza Khan's accession to the throne. Amending several articles of the 1906-1907 constitution, the Majlis dissolved itself and announced the convening of a constituent assembly to determine the country's political future. Before the final vote on abolishing the Qajar dynasty, Mudarris, in his characteristically disparaging manner, left the chamber in protest, shouting, "Not even 100,000 votes will make it right." Four independent deputies stayed to speak against the bill, however, though all praised Reza Khan's service to the nation. Hassan Taghizadeh, hero of the constitutional period, questioned the constitutionality of the bill and proposed an expedient way out. The English-educated moderate, Hossein Allah, raised similar concerns. Mohammad Mossadegh, the most articulate in the group, argued rather shrewdly that elevating Reza Pahlavi to the status of a constitutional king would only deprive the nation of an effective prime minister and reformer. Yahya Dowlatabadi, the most daring of the four, spoke, if we trust his memoirs, of the ongoing threats and intimidation by Reza Khan's agents to deliver votes in favour of the bill. Though appreciative of Pahlavi's service, he nonetheless aired his displeasure with the hereditary monarchy, perhaps the only regret expressed, and implicitly at that, over abandoning the republican option. Fearing personal harm, each speaker immediately left the chamber after his speech. They all knew that their opposition to the bill was merely symbolic. It was as if they were delivering a eulogy for the constitutional revolution just 2 decades after its birth. On December 12, 1925, the newly convened Constituent Assembly unanimously voted for the new Pahlavi hereditary monarchy, and 3 days later, Reza Khan was sworn in as the new Shah. The coronation ceremony, in late April 1926, was staged as a joyful celebration, very different from the solemnity of the Shi'i public culture. It was an event meant to announce clearly the advent of a modern era, with street decorations, banners, electrical lights and lanterns, stamp issues, victory arches, and, of course, lengthy homilies glorifying the new reign. Yet the very act of coronation helped to reaffirm and, in the process, reinvent the same monarchical tradition that the Pahlavi regime was replacing, albeit with a touch of borrowed European style, typical of the period. The Shah sat on an armchair atop the marble throne in the open veranda of Golestan Palace, and donning a royal robe over his military uniform, He received people in the palace courtyard as Fath Ali Shah and Nasiruddin Shah had before him, but without wearing the Kayanid crown of the Qajars. The new Pahlavi crown, crafted for the occasion, was inspired by the Achaemenid scaling-up motifs as appeared on the ramparts of Persepolis. The Islamic side of the coronation ceremony was scaled down accordingly. Long before the coronation, remnants of the Qajar house were cleared out of Golestan Palace and other royal properties. A few days before the detrimental Majlis vote, the new regime replaced the palace guards with regular troops. Immediately afterward, the Prince Regent Muhammad Hassan Mirza and his small entourage left for exile. To humiliate the last icon of Qajar sovereignty, Reza Shah paid the Prince Regent for his travel expenses in the smallest denomination of silver coins, which were delivered in leather purses by a ranking general of the Pahlavi army who had headed the palace guards. The troops drove the prince and his attendants to the border and unceremoniously dumped them at the Iraqi custom house in Khanigain. To symbolically right the wrongs of the founder of the Qajar dynasty, one of Reza Shah's earliest acts was to order that the remains of Karim Khan Zand be exhumed from the Ivan of Golestan Palace and reinterred in Shiraz. This was the end of 150 years of rule by the Qajars, a dynasty that had survived as only a shadow of itself since the Constitutional Revolution. But if the Qajar dynasty came to an end, its legacy endured not so much in the institutions of the government as in the blood of the Iranian elite, who had long intermarried with the vast Qajar progeny. The Pahlavi regime co-opted this old elite, some to serve in the bureaucracy, and the rest to hold on to their land and property. Many were impoverished and eventually lost out to the new classes, but a few survived and even thrived for another generation or two. During the first decade in power, Reza Shah and his military and civilian supporters were poised for a massive leap forward. They felt supremely confident that they would be able to fulfill the long-awaited national aspirations for sovereignty and material progress, and that they could successfully recast Iran as a modern nation and Iranians as refashioned citizens of such a nation. The mixed experiments with constitutional democracy over the previous two decades, foreign interventions, a self-serving political elite, and the inevitable disarray that came first with the Constitutional Revolution and then with World War I, had convinced most urban Iranians of the necessity of the alternative offered by Reza Shah. In Turkey, Italy, the Soviet Union, and soon Germany, many viewed the authoritarian state model as the only solution to post-war maladies. In 1925 and 1926, hundreds of flattering telegrams poured in from the provinces to congratulate the new monarchy. They were manufactured with a good deal of persuasion from army officers, yet they were not entirely empty of genuine sentiments. It was as if the whole nation were ready to make a new start. If the agenda for the new regime was essentially scripted in the constitutional period and set in motion in the post-constitutional era, then Reza Shah was the real agent who brought it to fruition. To do so, he relied heavily on a handful of loyal statesmen on whose vision and efficiency the Pahlavi order was built. As early as 1924, a group of four officials formed an informal alliance that placed them above the old Qajar cabal of the earlier decades. They aimed to harness Reza Khan's power toward creating a more institutionalized order and transform the regime's image from that of a mere military dictatorship. Yet it is wrong to assume that Reza Shah was just an overseer or a puppet in the hands of his chief ministers. To the contrary, reminiscent of Nasiruddin Shah's court, the Shah controlled his ministers and officers with persuasion, rivalry, and outright coercion, while increasingly falling into an entangling web of mistrust and fear. On the more positive side, the Shah was receptive to initiatives his ministers and advisers proposed and saw them through with tenacity. As long as the blend of ministerial initiative and dictatorial drive worked, there was a visible change in the affairs of state, at least in a material sense. The four civilian ministers soon dominated the new government and initiated many of the reform projects during the first decade of Pahlavi rule. They were from a younger generation of notables of the post-constitutional period who had gained power or preserved their privileges primarily because of their Western education. Abdul Hussein Temurtash, 1883-1933, son of a provincial Khorasan landowning notable, was a dashing young graduate of St. Petersburg Military Academy when, at the age of 29, he was elected to the second Majlis. Later, as governor of the province of Gilan, he left behind a record of cruelty, including the execution of Dr. Heshmat, a medical doctor and revolutionary intellectual who had joined the Jangyal movement but later was tricked into surrendering himself to the authorities. In 1922, as an influential deputy in the Fifth Majlis, he was instrumental in the rise of Pahlavi dynasty and soon was rewarded as the Shah's confidant and powerful court minister. Perhaps more than any other statesman, Temurtash helped shaping Reza Khan's public image. He regulated the Shah's access to the public, nurtured his taste for all things modern, dignified and even glamorized the Pahlavi court, and above all, helped restore equilibrium to Iran's foreign policy. Though Russian-educated, and for a while an Anglophile, under Reza Shah, he steered a steady course in tune with Iran's nationalist ethos. He was articulate and persuasive, flattering toward his master, and patronizing to his subordinates. His gambling, womanizing, and reckless drinking, reminiscent of the Tsarist army officer's lifestyle to which he had been exposed, was emblematic of the modern hedonism that came with breakdown of the traditional moral order. Reza Shah, who once considered him almost as his alter ego, at first rewarded his services handsomely, before turning against him with a vengeance. Dismissed and accused of the groundless charge of spying for the Soviets, in 1933 Temurtash was arrested and tried on a propped-up charge of bribery. Sentenced to 3 years' imprisonment, he was murdered in prison by the Shah's dreaded police chief. An ally of Temurtash in high office, Firuz Mirza Nosrat al-Dowleh, 1889-1937, was a savvy statesman of impeccable Qajar lineage and the promising senior son of the influential Abdul Hussein Mirza Farman Farmaw, 1857-1939, the scion of a powerful family. Having studied first in Beirut and then law in Paris, he was a deputy of the third and fourth Majlis, and in 1919, while still young, he had joined Vasug al-Dowleh's government as Minister of Justice and later of Foreign Affairs. Yet the failure of the Anglo-Persian agreement did not entirely destroy his career. Despite his apparent ambition for staging a coup in 1921, which was delayed because he was stranded on his way to the capital, he later welcomed Reza Khan's rise to power and, like Temurtash, was instrumental in consolidating the new dynasty. In 1925, he joined the cabinet as Minister of Finance and later Minister of Justice, and in collaboration with Temurtash, he carried through the earliest reform measures of the Pahlavi era. As the first of the four ranking aides to Reza Shah, however, Firuz was dismissed on a fabricated charge of embezzlement and put on trial. After his conviction, he was barred from government posts. In 1936, he was again arrested and sent into exile on no apparent charge, then murdered 2 years later. Well-informed, shrewd, and diplomatic, Firuz Mirza was an asset to the new Shah, strengthening the regime's ties with the old nobility and adding to Iran's international reputation. As an early victim of Reza Shah's paranoia, Firuz Mirza was viewed as a potential risk to the throne for his alleged proximity to the British. The third in the group, Ali Akbar Davar, 1885-1937, who came from a middle-ranking bureaucratic family, was most instrumental in overhauling the government administration. A Swiss-educated lawyer, he began as a left-leaning journalist and politician and was a founder of the Radical Party. In 1922, he formed a powerful bloc in the fourth and fifth Majlis supporting Reza Khan. A kingmaker, in the true sense of the word, he was the one who put forward the bill to abolish the Qajar dynasty, and he energetically defended the transfer of power to Pahlavi. As Minister of Public Works in 1925 and Minister of Justice between 1926 and 1932, and thereafter Minister of Finance, He was responsible for implementing the most radical reforms under Reza Shah, restructuring the judicial system and introducing modern civil and penal codes, as well as consolidating the framework for public finances that had first emerged under Schuster and later under British and American advisers. Davar was different in character and lifestyle from Temur Tash and distinct from Firuz Mirza in his mild temperament and lack of snobbishness. He was also ambitious and yet prudent and single-minded, serving perhaps as the most capable public administrator of the Pahlavi era, with a rare gift for fostering younger talent and transforming Iran's entire divan culture. As the high priest of the Pahlavi etatism, more than anyone else in high office, he promoted the cult of state intervention, which in the long run deteriorated into a malignancy. State hegemony, over-reliance on government services, and the waning of civil and private initiatives were predictable outcomes. In February 1937, in his early 50s, Davar committed suicide, apparently for fear of the paranoid Reza Shah and his perceptions of Davar's misconduct. He had already witnessed the downfall of his colleagues with the same imagined faults. Jafar Goli Asad Bakhtiari, son of the constitutional revolution leader Sardar Asad Bakhtiari, was the least political of the group. He was an important agent of stability in the early Pahlavi era, for contrary to his aristocratic and civilian colleagues, Asad descended from the leadership of Iran's largest tribal confederacy, which a decade earlier had established a political base in the capital and even stood a chance of constituting a Bakhtiari dynasty. His multiple appointments as Minister of War in early Pahlavi governments were meant to symbolize the compliance of the Bakhtiaris with the emerging Pahlavi order, a fragile compliance, no doubt, but effective enough to keep him in the Shah's favor as an advocate of the policies of pacifying the tribes and making them sedentary. Like his colleagues, however, he too would eventually fall victim to Reza Shah's suspicion. He was poisoned in prison and then murdered in March 1934. That all four victims fell to Reza Shah's regime denoted something more than Reza Shah's paranoid state of mind or sense of inferiority toward men of higher class and superior education, men whom, despite their genuine show of loyalty to him, the new Shah still viewed as a liability and potential threat. He utilized them to his own ends before destroying them, just as Nasser ad-Din Shah did many decades earlier. The Pahlavi ministers, a modern equivalent of the old Divan, were exposed even more than their Qajar predecessors to the whims and wishes of the Pahlavi Shah. One can attribute this remarkable continuity to the tenacity of a political culture that persisted even after the constitutional revolution, even after a mass movement that primarily aimed to contain and regulate the arbitrary power of the monarch and managed against all odds to oust the despotic Muhammad Ali Shah. Predictably, from the early 1930s, a number of officials and military officers came to occupy positions of power. Some were of the old families who adjusted themselves to Pahlavi rule. Others were members of the new middle classes. They proved less resolute and imaginative, more pliant to the Shah's wishes, and increasingly corrupt. Ironically, the fate of the four ministers proved almost identical to that of many intellectuals and political activists, tribal leaders, and elder Qajar statesmen who were spied on, kept under house arrest, sent into exile, put on trial, imprisoned on false charges, or quietly eliminated. Railroad and modern infrastructure. The efforts of the new state elite bore material results. For many Iranians, the construction of a railroad was the ultimate symbol of empowerment, and it was small wonder that the Pahlavi elite made railroad a priority. In 1925, the 6th Majlis passed the railway bill. Immediately, the Pahlavi state negotiated with British, German, and Danish firms over the planning and construction of the Trans-Iranian Railroad, which was to extend from the southwestern oil-producing province of Khuzestan on the Persian Gulf to Mozandaran on the northeastern shores of the Caspian. The north-south axis aimed to open the Iranian markets on both ends to the ports of the Persian Gulf and Caspian Sea, a strategy reminiscent of the Safavids' export of Gilan silk through the Persian Gulf, and later the British initiative to open the Karun-Bakhtiari link to Isfahan. Yet the Iranian railroad, as it turned out, functioned more as a means of hauling imports into the interior rather than exporting Iranian goods abroad or facilitating the domestic economy. By the mid-1920s, early signs of a rejuvenated Soviet economy built upon the ruins of industries of Imperial Russia raised Iranian hopes for a renewal of the old trade partnership with Russia, even though the world was at the outset of a global depression. In the south, the port of Khorramshahr, the old Mahamara, seemed a logical terminus for the railroad, given the growing domestic consumption of Khuzestan refined oil, as well as the vital need for modern port facilities for international shipping. Although economic and geopolitical realities later revealed the strategic vulnerabilities of the Iranian railroad, at the time it seemed a perfectly sound infrastructural project. True, the planners failed to design a national system to connect the major commercial cities of the interior. A northwest to southeast line seemed more viable for connecting Azerbaijan to Tehran and Isfahan, and through Yazd and Kerman to Bandar Abbas on the Persian Gulf, and from Tehran to the northeast to Mashhad. Yet one should be wary of conspiratorial myths common after World War II that accused Reza Shah of constructing the railroad to advance British strategic interests. The Khuzestan line, it can be argued, helped incorporate the oil-rich province into the state system and enforced Iranian sovereignty in the south despite British vested interests in the oil fields and the British alliance with the Banu Kab and the Bakhtiari Khans. Maintaining control of Khuzestan was crucial for the Pahlavi state, not only to boost its nationalist credentials, but also to facilitate Reza Shah's desire to claim a bigger share of the oil fields and their enormous revenue. In the long run, Khorramshahr became Iran's largest commercial harbour, facilitating the massive growth of trade with Europe and later with Japan and the United States, and catering to domestic demands for imported manufactured goods and raw materials. Financing the Tehran-Khuzestan line in 1927 with revenue from the state's sugar monopoly, one of several monopolies on consumer goods introduced during this period, the southern line became operational by 1929. By 1930, with the construction of the Karun Bridge, two-thirds of a mile long, then the longest steel bridge in the Middle East, the railroad reached the Persian Gulf. By 1936, the 82-mile stretch of picturesque mountainous railroad from the capital to the newly constructed Caspian port of Bandar-e-Shah, now Bandar-e-Torkaman, became operational. A project of considerable complexity, the Trans-Iranian Railroad negotiated steep gradations of the Elburz and Zagros ranges through numerous tunnels, bridges, and passes. When, in 1938, it officially opened, the total cost of the Trans-Iranian Railroad was estimated at 10.1 billion rials, $500 million, making it the most expensive and most extensive project ever in modern Iranian history, except perhaps for the British-owned oil industry and refinery installations. The rail system was the cornerstone of the infrastructure revolution under the early Pahlavids, even though it was never fully incorporated into the country's traditional commerce or into the new network of roads that linked the capital to the provinces. Centralization required easy access to the provinces, and a growing number of motor cars offered new roads as an alternative to rail. Already by 1921, there was a network of dirt roads navigable by cars. These were either improved Qajar carriage roads, such as the Tehran-Rasht and Tehran-Gom roads, or were roads inherited from the Allied armies that connected northern and western cities to the capital, or the ports of the Persian Gulf to Shiraz, or cities like Isfahan and Mashhad to their surroundings. The Pahlavi reliance on motorized logistics to quell the Jangel movement and tribal uprisings in the provinces, especially in Fars and Luristan, soon demonstrated the relatively low cost of road transportation compared to the railroad for moving troops, and soon after the movement of peoples and goods. In 1926, the new Firuz Kah road connected the capital through the Elburz range to Reza Shah's birthplace in Savadku. It was followed in 1928 by the opening of the Loristan Road across the Zagros Range. The former facilitated the development of the north, and the latter signified a desire to pacify the south. In 1933, the new 100-mile special, Mahsous Road, was completed. This third access to the Caspian through the central Elbeuz was a feat of civil engineering, for it negotiated the High Chalous Pass through tunnels and bridges, halving the travel time to the newly developed tourist resorts along the Caspian. For ordinary Iranians, who were accustomed to the hardships and slow pace of caravan travel, such triumphs over the rugged Iranian terrain earned the Pahlavi state awesome prestige. By the end of the 1930s, the road network of 14,000 miles, and along with it the culture of motorcars, trucks, and buses, had already begun to transform the face of Iranian cities and facilitate the demise of the province's isolation. For the rugged terrain of the Iranian plateau, roads and motor vehicles proved as much an agent of change as they were in industrial Europe and the United States, and despite incredible obstacles. At first, it was mostly Iranian Armenians and Assyrians, or foreign nationals from Russia, Azerbaijan, and Turkey, who chauffeured expensive cars for the wealthy, Ford Model Ts, passenger station wagons of the 1930s, and British-manufactured Leyland trucks. In 1928, Tehran registered 1,099 rental and taxi cabs and 490 private cars, in comparison to 459 horse carriages. All these vehicles were to abide by a traffic code introduced the same year. Less than two decades after the introduction of mass-produced cars in the United States, which was manufacturing 80% of motor cars in the world, Iranians, like people across Asia and the Middle East, adopted cars, created makeshift city and intercity transportation services, and hauled agricultural and semi-industrial goods to urban markets. With motor vehicles, there emerged a homegrown industry of repair and the manufacture of spare parts, dominated by the technologically savvy Armenians. As in the Safavid and Qajar periods, the Armenians of the post-constitutional and early Pahlavi periods, some of whom had emigrated from the Caucasus or eastern Turkey, contributed more than any other community to Iran's material modernization and technological culture. Rapid change was also visible in aviation. As early as 1916, British airplanes appeared over Iranian skies, first for reconnaissance, and then, in 1918, to bomb remnants of the Kurdish resistance in western Iran. By 1928, the German Junkers had established regular air service in Iran and neighboring lands. By the early 1930s, Iran had developed a viable air force of its own. Urban demolition and construction. No other modern invention changed the face of Iranian cities as the motor car did. This was the most visible impact of American mass culture on Iran's traditional cities. As early as 1921, the Pahlavi municipalities accelerated the overhaul of the late Qajar-era city administration, improving urban sanitation and establishing regular garbage collection, centralized telephone and electricity networks, street lighting, and police precincts. By the early 1930s, the most visible impact was the new thoroughfares for motor vehicle traffic, first along the newly developed northern edge of the capital, and then right through the heart of the old neighborhoods. Rebuilding and beautifying the capital and improving its sanitation were major priorities for the Pahlavi state, as well as a material projection of its power. Beyond functionality, which in the main meant removal of heaps of garbage and eliminating neighborhood looty street gangs, orderliness imbued a sense of power and confidence, which was conspicuously tied up with displays of Western-style progress. Urban advancement, often thinly concealing a sense of inferiority toward the West, was dressed up with broad avenues and the ever-present statue of the Shah in public squares. It was no surprise, therefore, that for most of the Reza Shah era, the replication of European city planning and street grids was presided over by a senior army officer and Reza Shah's former Cossack colleague, Karim Agha Bazarjomerhi. As mayor of Tehran, Bazarjomerhi lumped together military-style doggedness with a crude version of Baron Haussmann city planning, so as to implement in the capital, or impose upon it, an image of Pahlavi grandeur. With vengeance, he unleashed throughout the neighbourhoods of old Tehran an army of immigrant labourers, superimposing on the centuries-old, slow, undisciplined Qajar urban growth a grid of parallel avenues and streets. In the process, he destroyed the old fabric of city neighbourhoods, demolished their urban symbols, and forever ruined Tehran's delicate character of a walled city surrounded by gardens and green spaces at the southern slopes of the Elburz range. According to one count at the turn of the 20th century, there were at least 24 major Persian gardens in and around Tehran, nearly all of which fell victim of urban growth and construction booms over a period of half a century. As the novelist Bazarg Alavi put it, it was as if Pahlavi modernity could not be brought into the capital without first destroying all 12 city gates built in the Nasiri era. The bazaar neighbourhood was cut through with a characterless broad street, bisecting the old business and economic centre. It was appropriately named after the mayor himself. The adjacent Sangelaj neighbourhood, important as a centre of activity during the constitutional revolution, was emptied of its inhabitants and completely razed to the ground to provide space for a Western-style city park. As European-style residential and commercial buildings went up in northern Tehran, often replacing the grand old houses in Persian or Perso-European style, or replacing barren land, old gardens, and agricultural plots, the older neighbourhoods fell into disrepair and eventually housed the urban poor and new immigrants. In the short period between 1921 and 1941, the face of Tehran substantially changed. Avenues and cars replaced narrow alleys and horse carriages. New neighbourhoods of modern houses were constructed, often in the Western style, but built with traditional Persian construction materials. From the late 1920s, Tehran witnessed the construction of a number of grand public buildings. Among the earliest was Rolleston Hall of the Elburz American Presbyterian College, completed in 1927, and the Tehran Central Post Office, completed in 1934, both designed by the Georgian architect Nikolai Markov, 1882-1957, and inspired by Persian architecture of the Islamic era. The Iran Bastan Museum and the National Library of Iran, both completed in 1937, were designed by André Godard, 1881-1965, a French architect and director of Iran's archaeological service under Reza Shah, in a tasteful style inspired by Sasanian architecture. From 1934 to 1941, a mixed group of European and Iranian architects oversaw the construction of the campus of Tehran University. Yet other public buildings, such as National Police Headquarters, completed in 1935, and the National Bank of Iran, completed in 1938, were examples of an architectural archaism then in vogue. These buildings were inspired by the ancient Persian colonnade style of Persepolis and employing the Zoroastrian symbol of Ahura Mazda atop Achaemenid-style columns. Most of these public buildings, as well as a chain of luxury hotels on the Caspian's shores, public schools in major Iranian cities, and royal palaces, were designed and constructed under Reza Shah's supervision. He was well aware of the importance of public buildings as physical projections of state authority, just as his Safavid and Qajar predecessors were. The presence of many European and European-educated architects engaging in public projects, though, transformed Iran's architectural style. Plans for most of these public buildings complied with requisites of modern functional architecture, but they were often clad in a thin veneer of Persian architectural references. Even the old royal citadel, the Arg, that had developed over a century under the previous dynasty, was not spared from the new construction boom. Major buildings of the Qajar complex, including the royal residential quarters, were razed to make room for the Ministry of Justice and later on the Ministry of Finance and for other government departments. These new structures represented the growth of the state's sprawling bureaucracy. Symbolically and physically, they were built in place of the Qajar royal palaces and divan buildings, as if the new regime were anxious to erase traces of the previous dynasty's physical manifestations of kingship and statecraft. Soon thereafter, and increasingly in the 1940s and 1950s, Most provincial centres were also subjected to the forces of Europeanised modernity, and with mixed outcomes. Nearly in all towns and cities, the walls and city gates were the earliest victims of urban growth. Thereafter, the old neighbourhoods were gradually demolished or badly segmented by the introduction of the Western grid. Many instantly turned into slums. With the coming of Western-style architecture, the existing swirling pathways and gated alleys, local shopping rows, subterranean irrigation network of ghanats, public reservoirs, ice-making structures, bathhouses, madrasas, tekiyes, and houses of strength, zurkhanes, where young and old in the neighbourhood exercised and fraternised, either demolished or left to become dilapidated. Many old houses with magnificent cooling towers, outer and inner quarters, quadrangles with a refreshing mix of symmetrical gardens surrounding a fresh water pool, fell to disrepair. Many were divided and sold, often replaced by cheap and ugly residential quarters that were shabby imitations of Western modern architecture. Some of the most egregious demolitions of old quarters and historical edifices took place without the slightest alarm in Shiraz, Isfahan, Kashan and Kerman, wiping out some Safavid, Zand and Qajar residents. Yet in Tehran and in the provinces, urban amenities improved in the prosperous neighbourhoods, streets and avenues were paved, and rows of trees appeared along the newly constructed avenues. New shops and small shopping centres offering Western imports served the more affluent middle classes, and European-style hotels and restaurants popped up. An inevitable Pahlavi Avenue in every major city, a symbol of order, cleanliness and security, was a contrast in the eyes of citizens with the crooked, dark and unsafe alleys of the old neighbourhoods. Economy and industry. The centralising economy of the early Pahlavi era was characterised by the state's intervention in finance, modern banking, trade and industrialisation. Some of the state's initiatives echoed aspirations of the constitutional period, and others in the 1920s and 1930s were modelled on the economic policies of the neighbouring Soviet Union and the Republic of Turkey. Thanks to the growing population, urbanisation, greater consumption, and new sources of revenue, including royalties from the Anglo-Persian Oil Company, the economy grew in size and diversified. The overhauling of state finances and the state's investments in infrastructure and industry were in contrast to the non-interventionist and chronically bankrupt economy of the Qajar state. The population growth was particularly remarkable. In 1921, the population of Iran was estimated to be slightly above 11 million, with less than 1% annual growth. By 1941, the first official census placed the total population at 14,760,000. The annual population increase of about 1.5% for the two decades of Reza Shah's rule resulted in part from lower infant mortality, but also from fewer outbreaks of cholera and typhus. Urban growth was particularly notable, with the population of Tehran in 1941 for the first time exceeding 500,000, Isfahan 200,000, and Shiraz less than 130,000. Between 1929 and 1941, the state budget also grew more than 11-fold, from 31 million tumans income and 34 million tumans expenditure, to more than 361 million tumans income and 432 million tumans projected expenditure. Old patterns persisted, especially in the countryside. The economy remained essentially agrarian, with no major changes in land ownership or mechanisation, while the pastoral nomadic economy remained at a standstill or took a turn for the worse. The bazaar began to lose its age-old grip on commerce and manufacturing, resulting in the decline of the traditional mercantile sector, and this in turn hindered the growth of a capitalist bourgeoisie in the bazaar. The global economic depression and collapse of the financial markets in the United States and subsequently in Europe also had dire repercussions in Iran, as in the rest of the world, leading to rampant bankruptcies in the 1920s and 1930s among the cash-strapped and credit-laden bazaar merchants. Unemployment rates also rose in the traditional sectors that relied on workshop weaving and carpet industries and on small-scale imports and exports. The slow recovery of the Soviet economy also contributed to Iran's recession, as much of the Iranian network in Baku, Tiflis, Ashgabat, and Tashkent had perished during the Stalin era due to confiscation, forced repatriation, and economic hardship. The arrested growth of the private sector, the widening gap between living standards in the city versus the countryside, and the rise of the state's reliance on independent income through monopolies on commodities and oil revenue were the most significant legacies of the first Pahlavi era. While the state became less dependent on its citizens and the meagre revenue it could extract through taxation, it sped up military and police spending to safeguard the increasingly unpopular regime. To maintain its presence in nearly all economic sectors meant that the state should become the largest employer in the country by far. These patterns persisted through the whole of the Pahlavi era and beyond, with few exceptions, a curse on the modern Iranian political economy that continues to the present. Like other state-run economies, the early Pahlavi period also proved increasingly inefficient, another legacy handed down through the decades. Centralizing and modernizing state finances was the Pahlavi regime's first priority. The Schuster mission in the constitutional period, and later British and other European administrators employed by the Iranian government, had partially reformed the state's financial machinery and helped increase public revenues, despite domestic and foreign opposition. In 1922, the Iranian government employed Dr. Arthur Millspaugh, 1883-1955, a former advisor to the U.S. State Department's Office of Foreign Trade, and his team of American financial experts to update Iran's finances and generate greater state revenue, especially through taxation of the tribal territories. Employing Millspaugh was a gesture of defiance in the face of the bitter memory of the 1911 ultimatum and Schuster's forced departure. Over the course of nearly 5 years as Treasurer-General, Millspaugh tried with some success to apply the American model of internal revenue collection while the British war subsidy was being phased out, as well as to rationalize fiscal policies, produce detailed annual budgets with set goals for incomes and expenditures, and reduce inefficiency and influence peddling. The relative success of the Millspaugh mission helped consolidate the Pahlavi state at a critical juncture. The still minuscule 16% royalties from production and export of Iranian oil that began to trickle in, after a great deal of post-war altercations and in the face of Anglo-Persian oil companies' disingenuous accounting practices, was a vital shot in the arm, but it was not sufficient. Even though Millspaugh contemplated increasing income through monopolies, he resisted direct state intervention in the market. Yet a greater challenge for Millspaugh was Reza Shah and his minister's desire to increase military expenditures through, among other ways, exclusive allocation of the oil royalties, which the American advisor resisted. Under pressure from the Shah, in June 1927, Millspaugh resigned, giving way to swift implementation of a series of measures that reshaped Iran's economic future. By 1928, the oil revenue reserve had reached 6 million tumans, $3,518,000 US dollars, a hefty sum that was meant to be devoted to economic development, but was instead appropriated by the state to consolidate the military and pay for the growing bureaucracy. The sugar monopoly was imposed in 1927 to pay for the construction of the railroad, followed in 1929 by a monopoly on the sale and export of opium, and thereafter on tobacco and other commodities. As a sign of the changing times, control of the commercial markets faced no resistance from the bazaar, in stark contrast to the tobacco protest of 1891-1892, or the protests against government price controls on the eve of the Constitutional Revolution. This was another cause of the bazaar's reluctance to abandon the small-scale patterns of patronage and networking in favor of investment in modern financial and industrial sectors. A weakened bazaar and the relative worsening of the affairs of the bazaar merchants meant that the middle and lower ranks of traders and guilds suffered. The ensuing growth of conservatism in the bazaar surfaced in a firmer alliance with the conservative clergy, the other losing sector in Pahlavi society. The new banking network further strengthened the state's hold over the market at the expense of the bazaar. By the end of the Reza Shah era, at least four major Iranian banks were operating: the National Bank, the Pahlavi Bank for Army Veterans, Bonke Sepa, the Mortgage Bank, and the Agricultural Bank. They partially replaced not only the old money-lending institutions of the bazaar and their system of promissory notes and pledges, but also the small-scale financial networks that had been in operation since the late Qajar era, such as the Armenian-Tumanian Brothers, who had branches in Iranian cities and partners in European capitals, and the Zoroastrian banking houses. Fulfilling one of the earliest demands of the constitutional period, in 1928 the National Bank of Iran, Banque Millie Iran, was established, with initial capital of 2 million tumans, approximately $1,172,000, that only partially was paid. It was envisioned in the Banking Act of 1927 as an institution to promote commerce, agriculture, and industry. In practice, it functioned more as the central bank.